part of Israel's religious war against Islam's holy sites. And the U.S. House of Representatives is without a leader for the first time in history after Republican lawmakers vote to oust its speaker. Thank you for joining us. In today's top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution slams the government's pursuing normalization with Israel, likening it to betting on a losing horse. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says Tel Aviv is replete with hatred and rage and antagonistic towards both Iran and all its own neighbors. He also hailed the Palestinian group's preparedness to resist the occupation. Ayatollah Khamenei added that Israel is like cancer that will certainly be eradicated by the Palestinian people and the resistance forces. The leader also touched upon the recent desecrations of the Quran, saying such acts will not weaken the holy book. Ayatollah Khamenei called on Islamic countries in West Asia and North Africa to unite to prevent US pillage, coercion and interference. He said if Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan and the Persian Gulf countries adopt a single policy in general issues, the bullying powers will not be able to interfere in their internal affairs. Iran's leader was addressing the participants of the Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. High-ranking officials, including Iran's president and parliament speaker, were also in attendance. Meanwhile, political commentator Shabir Rizvi says Iran's leader calling Israel a losing horse is materializing through the regime's internal and external issues. Let's take a listen.
As we look at the Zionist occupation itself, internally, it's marked by strife. It's about to reach its 40th week of internal riots. And externally, we see the Zionist occupation being lambasted, being objected to, being condemned by not only international orgs, but slowly and surely, world governments themselves are joining in. And that's just even outside of Islamic governments and as well. As we see, you know, the city of Barcelona for some time cut off relations with Israel, with Tel Aviv, quote unquote. We see, you know, members of the West, even like some cities in Australia, rising against the Zionist regime. So all this to say, the already very small popularity of the Zionist regime is dwindling. And so you're betting on a dying horse, on a losing horse, essentially.
Iran's foreign minister has called for coordination amongst Muslim countries to counter the desecration of Islamic sanctities and values through, quote, firm and wise measures. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said insults against Islam were becoming insidious. He urged thinkers in the Muslim world to increase interaction in order to promote unity and tackle existing challenges. The top Iranian diplomat was speaking with a senior official of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation who has attended the Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. Some European countries have recently been host to sacrilegious acts against the Holy Quran. The desecration has taken place with the go-ahead given by authorities amid protection provided by the security apparatus. The Muslim world has been the scene of major protests in condemnation of the profane move. The first edition of Iran's International Media Festival has wrapped up in the northeastern city of Mashhad. The festival brought together journalists from across the world to discuss women's role in shaping public opinion. The event, dubbed Khorshid, which translates into sun as a symbol of enlightenment, was directed by Marzia Hashemi, who is a veteran journalist herself. Here's more.
Honoring slain journalist Shireen Abu Akla, the prominent Palestinian-American journalist who was assassinated by Israeli forces last year, women journalists came together in the northeastern city of Mashhad to send a strong message that women's full participation in public and political life is essential in addressing the multiple crises mankind is confronting in today's world. The International Khorshid Media Festival became the platform for these independent women journalists to share their experiences and thoughts on stories rarely covered by mainstream media. And some outstanding media reports were also awarded. The woman behind it all, American-Iranian broadcaster and Press TV host Marzia Hashemi, explains.
With this conference, what we're trying to do is to unite with perspectives from the alternative media and to try to expand Well, you know, our slogan at Press TV, being the voice of the voiceless, well, we want to make sure that voice of the voiceless is getting louder and louder. And we're hoping with the cooperation with, we have people here from over 45 countries, that we can make it happen.
An important issue that was also highlighted by the Iranian president's wife, who was the keynote speaker at the panel discussion of the festival, as well as the president himself, who held a meeting with the visiting journalists.
In different arenas in this media war, where there are different versions of the same stories, it is important to give voice to journalists who are telling the true stories. In many cases, strong and brave women are doing exactly that.
And the participants are already on board.
Just as Mrs. Alam Al Huda, the president's wife, explained today, we live in a world where there is a hegemony on news, and certain news outlets tell the entire world what the problems are and what the solutions should be. And that has become a norm.
In this venue, you know, we have a situation where we can hear the voices of the voiceless from around the world, basically. We have people from Latin America, we have people from Africa, from Asia, from America. So here it's a good opportunity to start a project that can break that norm, basically, that colonialized norm. We are looking forward to a new future.
Met with the support of a huge number of independent journalists, the Secretariat announced that this festival will be held every 2 years.
The Khorshid Media Festival is an effort to bring together women journalists from across the world to cover important issues and to give a voice to voices that have been muffled by mainstream media. Gizum Shahmadi, Mashhad.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned a recent move by the Israeli regime to prevent Muslim worshippers from entering holy sites in the occupied territories. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem said it's been a serious escalation of the Israeli religious war on the Islamic holy sites. He said the move reflects the regime's disregard for the Arab Muslim sentiment. The Hamas official urged young Palestinians to keep up the struggle against Israel. The regime authorities recently banned Muslim worshippers from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds as well as the Ibrahimi Mosque in Al-Khalil. Political infighting in the U.S. House of Representatives has plunged Congress into deeper chaos. The lower chamber has voted to remove Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
On this vote, the yeas are 216, the nays are 210. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The office of Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
The Republican was dismissed in a historic vote triggered by a rare challenge from his own party. Republican Representative Matt Gaetz filed a motion late Monday to force a vote on removing McCarthy. Gaetz and a handful of allies criticized McCarthy for relying on Democratic votes to pass a temporary funding measure that headed off a partial government shutdown. He launched a scathing attack on McCarthy in his House speech.
Mr. Speaker, my friend from Oklahoma says that my colleagues and I who don't support Kevin McCarthy would plunge the House and the country into chaos. Chaos is Speaker McCarthy. Chaos is somebody who we cannot trust with their word. The one thing that the White House, House Democrats, and many of us on the conservative side of the Republican caucus would argue is that the thing we have in common, Kevin McCarthy said something to all of us at one point or another that he didn't really mean and never intended to live up to.
Some Republicans have also expressed frustration over a deal McCarthy made with President Biden earlier this year to cap spending levels in return for raising the debt ceiling. Tuesday's vote marked the first time in U.S. history a speaker has been ousted. Meanwhile, Kevin McCarthy has spoken to media representatives after he was voted out of his job. McCarthy has blasted what he called institutional problems in the U.S. Congress.
You know what's interesting? Everybody's sitting there. In today's world, if you're sitting in Congress and you took a gamble to make sure government was still open, and eight people can throw you out as Speaker, and the Democrats who said they wanted to keep government open, I think you've got a real divide. I think you've got a real institutional problem. My fear is the institution fell today. Because You can't do the job if eight people, you have 94% of, or 96% of your entire conference, but eight people can partner with the whole other side. How do you govern?
The former U.S. House Speaker was referring to the eight hard-right Republicans who joined 208 Democrats to oust him. McCarthy described them as angry and chaotic. He added that he won't attempt to reclaim his post as House Speaker. McCarthy did not say whether he plans to remain a member of Congress. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea has criticized the United States for describing Pyongyang and certain countries as threats in its strategy on countering weapons of mass destruction. In a statement, the DPRK's defense ministry spokesperson called the move a political provocation against sovereign states. He added that the country will counter the U.S. strategy with the, quote, most overwhelming and sustained response. Last week, the DPRK adopted a constitutional amendment that secures acceleration of nuclear weapons production in the face of Western provocations. The Pentagon's WMD strategy statement, which came out last week, has criticized or categorized the DPRK as a, quote, persistent threat, Russia as an acute threat, and China as a pacing threat. The Pentagon has released a WMD document for the first time since 2014. Tensions are mounting between India and Canada over the murder of a Canadian Sikh activist in India. This time, New Delhi has demanded that scores of Canadian diplomats leave India within a week. We have discussed the issue with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a look.
And now welcome everyone to our news review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Diplomatic rift between India and Canada deepens further, with New Delhi now calling on Ottawa to withdraw dozens of its diplomats from the country. India has reportedly asked Canada to repatriate some 41 diplomats by the 10th of October. A British daily has cited sources familiar with the Indian demand that New Delhi has even threatened to revoke the diplomatic immunity of those staffers who remain in the country beyond that deadline. Tensions between the two escalated after the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau accused New Delhi of being involved in the killing of Sikh activist Hardeep Singh Nijjar in June. Nijjar was a member of the Khalistan movement that has been long demanding an independent Sikh state in India for decades. Right-wing Indian government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi rejected any involvement in his killing. Joining us now for our news review program is Aidan Jonah, founder and editor-in-chief at The Canada Files. Join us from Toronto, and Shobhan Saxena, Indian journalist and political commentator, joining us out of Sao Paulo. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in Sao Paulo with you, Mr. Saxena. Hope you're safe and doing well. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, India and Canada, maybe they don't have the most elaborate trading regimen, but nevertheless, there's about $4 billion that India exports and about $4.1 billion that it imports. A very balanced trade between the two. It's not astronomical, but nevertheless, it's not by any means a small amount. There's a lot at stake here, is basically what I'm trying to say. Your initial thoughts on the story.
Thank you very much for having me. Of course, the trade between India and Canada is about $11 billion, not very big amount if you compare with other countries. But unfortunately, the relations between the two countries have taken a very negative turn in past couple of weeks. And it happened basically because the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, he went public with very serious allegation accusing the Indian government of masterminding and executing a murder on the Canadian soil of Hardeep Singh Nijjar, who was a Canadian citizen but of Indian origin. Now, he has alleged that he has some credible allegations against the Indian government, which is based on intelligence. Now, we have to remember, intelligence is assessment, intelligence is not evidence. And so far, the Canadian government has not produced any evidence or not shared any evidence with the Indian government. And Indian government has completely rejected this allegation and also accused Canada of hosting people who are indulging in anti-India activities. We also have to remember that in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s, India had a very bloody, very brutal militant movement in Punjab where thousands of people were killed, not just in Punjab, but across India. And it was a big setback to Indian unity. And it was largely funded and financed and orchestrated by people who have been based in US and Canada. And these people continue to use Canadian soil for anti-India activities.
Thank you, Mr. Saxton. And Mr. Aidan Jonah, welcome to the program. They're now, Aidan, two nations that are, it's funny, very ironic, former British colonies, one both British and French, and the Canadians. Your thoughts on Justin Trudeau's comments and the fact that Mr. Saxena says that there's so much at stake here. They both belong, forget about trade, but they also belong, both of them, to the G20 and other organizations. There's a lot at stake here. Your thoughts about this allegation without putting the backing in front of the Canadian people to support the allegations he's making against New Delhi?
I think it's pretty clear that people should be skeptical of this. And CSIS, as I've mentioned before, has a very questionable history with India. I mentioned the Air India 182 bombing, because frankly, CSIS knew full well about that plot. And of course, you had Parmar, the terrorist who Canada refused to extradite in 1982, Babar Khalsa member, founder, actually. And they refused to extradite him on the grounds that India wasn't sufficiently loyal to the Queen, because they recognized her as the head of the Commonwealth instead, of course. And then the Air India bombing happens, CSIS knew full well about it. And it's understandable that there's skepticism, you know, CSIS's conduct in terms of targeting land defenders, in terms of targeting left-wing activists, and even with the Chinagate hysteria that they've pushed in Canada, where it's a CSIS leaker, a quote-unquote leaker. I mean, I personally think CSIS was behind this leaker, to be quite frank. You know, they've manipulated Canadian politics, and they've really been very aggressive in it. But I think for Trudeau, the big thing to me is that, you know, they utilize these extremist diasporas, just like Canada utilizes the Uyghur diasporas, like the Tibetan diasporas. Obviously, I'm not saying they're separate countries.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us, and stay safe to the both of you, Mr. Aidan Jonah. They're joining us out of Toronto, and Mr. Shobhan Saxena joining us from Sao Paulo. This brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می‌کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, in a couple of episodes, we have dealt with the views of Iranian-Armenian University lecturer Yervand Abrahamian on the character of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution. The gist of his views on Imam Khomeini is that the Imam ably united people from all walks of life under the banner of Islam to struggle against foreign hegemony and domestic despotism. As from this episode, we will make you familiar with the views of John Foran, another Western thinker on the character of the greatest leader of the past centuries, Imam Khomeini. Stay tuned, please. John Foran is a professor in California University, Santa Barbara. He got his specialist PhD in sociology from Berkeley University in 1998. Foran has studied for years on revolutions and social movements in various regions. However, he concentrated his MA thesis and PhD dissertation on social changes in Iran during the recent centuries. His studies led to his authoring of the book, Fragile Resistance. This book made him globally renowned. John Foran has also written dozens of articles on valid dailies and magazines. The American thinker is mostly affected by leftist schools and tries to go through Iran's developments through the same spectacles. Fragile Resistance reviews social developments in Iran during more than half a millennium, that is, from the Safavid rule till the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in early 1979. This researcher, using the theory of development, tries to present a comprehensive review of the Iranian history in these centuries with an analysis of Iran's relations with the West. Foran applies the theory of development in three parts. First, he goes through the pre-capitalist era, 1500 to 1800 AD. Then he gives a picture of the years 1800 to 1925, spanning the era of the Qajari dynasty. In the last part, he reviews the social structure in Iran during the Pahlavi rule. The gist of the book, Fragile Resistance, is that Iranians get united very easily and soon against an enemy. But once they gain victory, this victory becomes shaky and the resistance perishes. The American University lecturer believes that, owing to the interference and infiltration of foreign forces and their support for despotic kings, and the disunity of constitutionalist elements, their movement was deviated from the main route and the resistance of the constitutionalists was broken down. John Foran maintains that the nationalization of oil industry was the second opportunity which the Iranians lost. He opines that the failure of this movement caused the country to be trapped in another cycle of dependent development and compression of social forces by the repressive government. Therefore, the Third Revolution took place with the struggles against the internal despotism and external hegemony. In other words, Foran believes that the Islamic Revolution was a combination of the constitutionalist movement against domestic dictatorial regime and the oil nationalization movement against the British dominance. He is of the opinion that both the previous movements were defeated as a result of lack of continuous resistance and perseverance of masses, which paved the way for broader and stronger intervention of foreigners and enemies of the nation. John Foran then points to the developments after the 1953 coup d'etat, which was orchestrated and staged by the British and American spying agencies. This coup created a new era of dependence on the West, especially the US. Thus, the United States became the real ruler of Iran as of political, economic, social, cultural, and military decisions and deals had to be confirmed by Washington to put into effect. This excessive dependence on the West, and the U.S. in particular, caused many small producers and businesses lose their job and leave the economic scene. The so-called land reforms by the Shah caused farmers or workers to lose their jobs and evacuate villages. This wrong policy increased the problems of cities manifold and made the rich super rich and the poor destitute. The Shah had turned into a stooge who subserviently and docilely obeyed whatsoever his masters in Washington would dictate him. Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was very ambitious, particularly in the field of military expenses. But once the oil revenues shrank, unemployment and inflation surged, resulting in new rounds of foreign loans. The American University professor John Foran believes that these developments led to social dissent and unrest, which ultimately caused the Islamic Revolution in 1978 to 1979. Nevertheless, the opponents of Shah from all walks of life were united under a single banner, which was in the able hands of Imam Khomeini. The Imam invited the people to stage calm and peaceful protests and demonstrations across the country and go on strikes in various economic sections to paralyze the regime. Foran admits that Imam Khomeini was the beloved, charismatic leader of the revolution, who very well united all strata and made them a single voice against the gendarme of the region, as the Shah liked to be called in the years leading to the Islamic Revolution. Dear listeners, in the next episode, we will continue to review Foran's views on Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and congratulations to you all on the blessed birthday anniversary of the Seal of Messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today also happens to be the birth anniversary of the Holy Prophet's sixth infallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. In honor of this day of double blessing, we have selected for you an enlightened statement from the Holy Prophet. I was sent by God to complete the best of morals.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the harms caused by following the carnal self in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear friends, it's an honor to be here in your presence. We are humbly speaking about how the following the desires of the carnal self will lead to harming our Islamic lifestyle. So this is a really important thing. We have talked about in previous programs how it is necessary to combat and to fight the lower self, this carnal self, this nafs, which encourages us towards worldliness and worldly pleasures and materialism in all its different various aspects. Now, with this in mind, it is pretty self-explanatory that if we don't fight against this nafs, if we don't fight against these base desires, then they will control us, and if they begin to control us, then we will spiral out of our Islamic lifestyle. Of course, Islamic lifestyle goes hand in hand with us as individuals being able to control our lower self, our base desires, and to be able to rise above these very worldliness and worldly things and this materialistic realm, and to be able to attain a higher realm when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back, dear friends. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how fighting against the carnal self and fighting against the nafs is something that is necessary. Now, we were also saying how if we don't fight this carnal self and this nafs, then of course this will harm our Islamic lifestyle. As we have said in many programs, living a Islamic, blessed, pure lifestyle is a lifestyle which is in balance with the cosmos. It is in balance with the commandments of the Almighty Allah. It is in line with the order that has been sent down for humanity, for the Almighty Allah. But when the nafs and the carnal desires and this greed and really insatiable greed for food or drink or reproduction or these kind of base desires, when these go out of control, then it starts to harm our balance. That balance, which is that Islamic lifestyle, it starts to harm our spirituality. It starts to even harm many of our social and familial interactions that we have. It even begins to hurt some of the relationships in our lives if we aren't able to keep it in control. And so at all costs, we must control ourselves and our nafs and our base desires so that we don't harm that blessed and pure Islamic lifestyle that we are trying to attain.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The reality of Amazon.
Part 2.
time, Apple controlled the music market with iPad and iTunes, and Bezos didn't want to lose his control over the book market. A year later, Bezos set up a lab in Silicon Valley. He asked his researchers to build a device to read digital books. In this laboratory, he said to the project officials, "You must develop a strategy in such a way that everyone who sells books in physical form will no longer have a job." It seemed that Bezos wanted to destroy himself. At the end of 2007, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos unveiled Kindle DX in New York. It was a simple and light device that could store 200 books downloaded from Amazon with a significant improvement compared to previous models. Bezos announced that the price of best-selling and new books would be $9.99 regardless of volume and quality. Bezos was inspired by the sale of 99-cent Apple songs on iTunes. The unveiling of Kindle DX once again attracted attention to Amazon. This showed that Bezos was very forward-thinking. Bezos was able to increase Amazon's revenue to about $15 billion in 2007. After almost 25 years since the establishment of Amazon, the income has reached $300 billion. This made Bezos the richest person on Earth with a fortune of $185 billion, higher than Bill Gates and Elon Musk. Bezos still keeps his old things in a corner of his office in Seattle to remember where he started and where he ended up. Now he has more than 580,000 employees all over the world. Amazon plays an important role in the employment of people in the United States of America. He has made the Amazon very similar to the Amazon River. And now for many of the 310 million users of this site, it is unimaginable to live a day without Amazon. However, if we travel to the Amazon forests, maybe our opinion will change completely. What we see from a distance is very different from the reality of Amazon. Barnes & Noble was the largest bookstore in the United States for many years. This bookstore, which started in 1886 in New York, now has nearly 627 retail stores across the United States. This bookstore is one of the most important competitors that was pushed out of the book market by Amazon, and now has to close several of its stores every year. Maybe the fate of this bookstore is the same fate as the Borders bookstore, which finally surrendered in 2011 after 32 years of experience and declared bankruptcy. Another 1,000 small bookstores filed for bankruptcy between 2000 and 2007. Now, Amazon's share of the printed book market is about 50%, and this share in the ebook market is about 75%. But the question is, how could Amazon bring such a disaster to traditional bookstores and publishers in less than a decade after its establishment?
More than 10,000 employees will lose their jobs as a result.
Getting the news today, it's upsetting. We tried. We tried. We gave it our best.
When Bezos started selling books online in the 90s, bookstores had been operating in the old way for almost 100 years. In this old way, publishers were paid very late and had to collect the returned books. They didn't have enough information about their customers. Bookstores acted instinctively. Amazon's sales method quickly attracted the attention of publishers. Publishers preferred to hand over the books to Amazon to sell them at a discount.
My present concern, though, is that Amazon, by selling what are called front list ebooks, that is, the books that are in most demand, by selling them below cost, are creating artificial incentives for people to move from physical books to ebooks. And I don't think that that's right.
The strange growth of Amazon and the profit that publishers received made them dependent on this company. Every time a book was introduced on Amazon, thousands of purchase requests were registered. Selling books became prosperous. Many believe that if Amazon had not been established, perhaps the book printing and book selling industry would have been disappeared by now.
Amazon was very important to the success of my book. I know that they do a lot of internal marketing efforts. They're able to tell what kinds of books people like, and therefore when they recommend a book to one of their customers, it's based on previous purchases and previous kinds of books that that person has read. So I do think that that really helped to get my book in front of potential readers.
When publishers became more dependent on Amazon, it was Bezos' turn to change Amazon's structure. Bezos believes that the whole market should be for himself alone. This means the maximum reduction in prices. So Amazon announced that from then on, publishers should give more discounts to Amazon, which reached up to 50% of the price of the back cover of the book. Bezos' decision greatly reduced publishers' profits. On the other hand, if a publisher like Macmillan rejected this offer, Amazon would remove the purchase option for this publisher's books, or customers wouldn't be able to see Macmillan's books on the front page of Amazon's website, which actually meant the destruction of publishers. Another important event in the new century was the change of Amazon's algorithms. Earlier, the editors and content producers recommended the books and reviewed them. But since 2000, it was the personalization algorithm that determined which books to recommend to whom. It was based on previous purchases and Amazon's knowledge of the customers. Then, if Amazon were to introduce a book, publishers would have to pay $10,000. According to Amazon's contract and confidentiality policies, it will never be known what effect these ads would have on sales. Kindle DX wireless reading device worsened the situation for the publishers.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Declining U.S. consumer confidence has cast shadows over its economy. According to reports, the U.S. consumer confidence is the lowest it's been in 4 months. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to China Daily, consumer sentiment is often regarded as the barometer of the U.S. economy, given that nearly 70% of it relies on consumer spending. However, recent data reveals a gradual decline in consumer confidence over the past few months, posing a potential threat to the holiday season. Data released by the Conference Board recently shows that its Consumer Confidence Index fell to 103 in September from 108.7, marking the most significant monthly drop since December 2020. According to Reuters, U.S. consumer confidence dropped to a four-month low in September, weighed down by persistent worries about higher prices and rising fears of a recession, though households remain generally upbeat about the labor market. The second straight monthly decline in confidence reported by the Conference Board recently also reflected higher interest rates and concerns about the political environment. The nation faces a potentially disruptive shutdown of the federal government amid political wrangling. Confidence fell across all age groups and was most pronounced among consumers with annual incomes of $50,000 or more. Christopher Ropke, chief economist at FWD Bands in New York, said inflation is slowing, but prices are still higher than they were before the pandemic, and this is taking a toll on consumer confidence. The Conference Board said its Consumer Confidence Index dropped to 103 this month, the lowest reading since May, from an upwardly revised 108.7 in August. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast the index easing to 105.5 from the previously reported 106.1. Consumers' perceptions of the likelihood of a recession over the next year ticked back up. A sharp decrease in the expectations measure accounted for the decline in confidence, which economists partially attributed to the looming government shutdown, with Congress so far failing to pass any spending bills to fund federal agency programs in the fiscal year starting on October 1st. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers will be furloughed, and a wide range of services, from economic data releases to nutrition benefits, suspended beginning. Dana Peterson, chief economist at the Conference Board in Washington, said consumers also expressed concerns about the political situation and higher interest rates. The cutoff date for the preliminary survey was September 18th. Millions of Americans will also start repaying their student loans in October, and most have run down their pandemic savings. The survey showed consumers increasingly concerned about their family finances. The Federal Reserve last week left its benchmark overnight interest rate unchanged at the 5.25% to 5.50% range. The U.S. Central Bank, however, stiffened its hawkish stance, projecting another rate hike by year-end and monetary policy staying significantly tighter through 2024 than previously expected. The Fed has hiked the policy rate by 525 basis points since March 2022. A separate from the Commerce Department showed new home sales plunged 8.7% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 675,000 units in August after rising to a 17-month high in July. Economists had forecast new home sales, which account for a small share of U.S. home sales, falling to a rate of 700,000 units. New home sales are counted as the signing of a contract, making them a leading indicator of the housing market. They, however, can be volatile on a month-to-month basis. Sales increased 5.8% on a year-on-year basis in August. Though new home sales remain supported by a dearth of previously owned homes on the market, the resurgence in mortgage rates is reducing affordability for prospective home buyers. The rate on the 30-year fixed mortgage vaulted above 7% in August and climbed to an average of 7.19%, the highest since July 2021, according to data from the mortgage finance agency Freddie Mac. Mortgage rates are rising in tandem with U.S. Treasury yields, which have surged on worries that soaring oil prices could hamper the Fed's fight against inflation. Nancy Vanden Heuten, lead U.S. economist at Oxford Economics in New York, said, "While we expect higher rates to hurt new home sales, we think they will be more resilient than existing home sales as builders seem willing to scale up their use of incentives to motivate sales." A third report from the Federal Housing Finance Agency showed annual home price growth quickened for a second straight month in July, largely reflecting the tight supply in the market for previously owned homes. House prices jumped 4.6% on a year-on-year basis in July. After rising 3.2% in June, prices shot up 0.8% month-on-month after advancing 0.4% in June. The resurgence in house prices was seen feeding through to higher inflation, likely giving the Fed cover to maintain its hawkish posture for some time. Bill Adams, chief economist at Commercia Bank in Dallas, said the Fed will see the re-acceleration of house prices as a reason to keep interest rates higher for longer. Renting households are seeing some relief in new lease prices, but since two-thirds of Americans are homeowners, the Fed cannot afford to look past house prices' influence on the cost of living.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we look at a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. Let me begin this episode by extending congratulations to the Muslim Ummah on the anniversary of the birth of the Mercy to Mankind, the greatest man to ever live, As-Sadiq al-Amin, Sayyidina Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. Now this week, millions of Muslims across the globe will be joining in celebrations. There's a difference of opinion on the exact date of the Wilada, but since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, the time between the dates has been known as Islamic Unity Week. Islamic Unity Week has been known to promote unity between Sunni and Shia Muslims across the world, the widespread celebrations taking place across the Ummah. Joining us today in the studio to talk about Mawlid al-Nabi and Islamic unity, we have two esteemed guests representing the scholarly class. We're lucky to have with us Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, a Muslim scholar and lecturer based here in the UK. And no stranger to the show, We're also joined by Brother Robert Carter, a journalist and researcher who has moved from the presenter's chair and now appears as a guest. Robert is a convert to Islam and his work focuses specifically on Muslim world affairs. Brothers, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show. Now, if I could perhaps start first with you, Sheikhna, and the Mawlud of the Prophet Muhammad. Now, how are some of the ways that Muslims can celebrate this Mawlud?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. That's a very good question. And I don't think it has a really definite answer. And I think the reason for this is the fact that the celebration of Mawlud is something that is particularly an aspect of Muslim culture. You know, it isn't related to the Sunnah, you know. Or you don't have any kind of precedent in the Quran for this. It is an expression of the love of Muslim communities for the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. And you know, just like, for example, you know, when you love somebody, you commemorate things about them. You celebrate their birthday. If they passed away, you commemorate their passing away and things like that. You remember them. I think, you know, different Muslim communities have evolved different ways by which you can commemorate or celebrate Mawlud. You know, you'd find different applications of it or different practices of it depending upon where in the Muslim world you are. So you find, for example, in Indonesia, it might have a particular form. In Sudan, it might have a particular form. In Bosnia, it might have a particular form, and so on. By and large, I believe that one of the driving factors for the commemoration of Mawlud would go to the mystical, or one could call it a Sufi understanding of Islam and their approach, which tends to be, and I use the word Sufi in a, you know, specific sense, not in terms of extremes and whatnot. And you would find that basically that school of thought, like in Shiaism, is one of love, you know, and this generates this type of specific approach to commemorating Mawlud.
Now, just on that point, you said that, you know, some Muslims celebrate it and it's not in the Sunnah, or perhaps it's not something that we see in the Quran itself. Now, there are some who don't celebrate it. What is the basis of perhaps some of the difference of opinions of people that maybe choose to opt out or say they don't want to celebrate this event?
Well, the group that tends to be not only critical but sometimes condemning of this is would be groups of people who tend to take a pretty, how should I say, black and white approach to Islam, you know, where they see things in a purely literalistic aspect, where the Sunnah, for example, is something only seen in its literalistic aspect and not the implications and metaphor and so forth that would be implied in that, you see. So, you know, for example, this group would see, for, you know, when the Quran says that Allah's hand is above the hand of your hand, they would say Allah has a hand, and they would take this literally, you see. And so I think they are not aware of what we call, I think in terms of, I think Carter Woodson, I believe it was. Hudson. The idea of Islamicate, you know, and the concept of Islamicate indicates the